Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news, live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 22nd of April. Coming up on the programme, a new political fight over the suspension of load shedding. And we'll look and see if the trend of suspension is sustainable. South Africa's 15 million rand a day kidnapping crisis. The emergence of a new Afrikaans leadership grouping and an offer of help to government. And why it's becoming so tough to own a home. It seems in some areas, particularly in the Eastern Cape, kidnappings are on the rise. Stats SA revealing that as of the 2022-23 financial year, the total number of kidnappings in South Africa reached just over 15,000 cases. Gauteng has the highest number with just over 7,000 reported. Well, what is behind this and what precautions can be taken? Leading the program today is Willem Els, a senior trading coordinator at the Institute for Security Studies. Willem, welcome to you and thank you very much for joining us. So there has been a notable increase.
Yes, yes. According to our statistics here at the ISS, over the past decade, it actually skyrocketed to about 260%, where you have several hotspots. But also what we saw is that in the last quarterly report of the police statistics, there were more than 4,500 cases reported. And that means there's about 51 kidnappings per day that are taking place in South Africa.
Why do you think this is happening?
Yeah, there are several reasons for that. You know, in the first place, I think there's almost a culture of impunity that developed in South Africa because of various reasons. One of them is a lack of police response and adequate arrest and prosecution of these guys. So they're getting away, and they think that they're getting away with it. And the more they think they're getting away with it, of course, the more they will do that. But what we also saw is that you have your hardcore groups that are focusing on that. They are very, very organized in doing so. And because it's so lucrative, then you have quite a few copycat gangs that come in, and then they just imitate what they are doing because they just seem to be getting away with it.
You use the word lucrative. Is the common motive then ransom, or is it more than that? Is it trafficking, maybe political influence or other reasons?
There are various reasons. Once again, you know, in the first place, you know, your average, according to the minister, your average ransom, and that is for businessmen, your more lucrative ones, are about 300,000 rand per case. But then you also have your express kidnappings. That is your people that are being hijacked or people that are taken hostage at the ATMs, and then they are being forced to withdraw cash. They're taken to the ATMs to withdraw cash. What also in recent months and in the last maybe two or three quarters started to surface is what it seems that they started to focus on your students. You know, your students are coming from your rural areas. They come into the big city. They're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. They come here, and they are very naive, and they are more and more becoming targets of these syndicates as well.
You spoke about the hotspots. Geographically, we've seen it's seemingly an uptick in the Eastern Cape, and particularly in the Port Elizabeth area. Is there a reason for that, do you think?
Yeah, I think in the Port Elizabeth area, it's not only the kidnap for ransom. We also saw a lot of mass shootings that took place in that area. We also saw a huge surge in gang violence. So it seems that criminality and your criminality levels overall have risen quite considerably in that area.
And do you think that South African law enforcement agencies are responding sufficiently to kidnapping challenges? Are they up to speed? Are they rising to the challenge here?
Well, if they were able to rise to the challenge, we wouldn't have seen these 260%
The increase.
skyrocketing. So that's on the one hand. You know, the South African Police Service, as your intelligence services, and most of the other services have been targeted by the state capture. They are slowly recovering from that, and it's going to take some time for them to recover. We also saw, you know, your trust levels between the police and the public. It's an all-time low. So many of your victims do not report it to the police because of a lack of trust, and also because they fear that they might be exposed, and also because of complicity by some of the police officers that are part of these gangs. So that makes it very difficult for the public to trust the police in order to investigate these cases. And that on the one hand. On the other hand, remember, there are quite a few good policemen and women that are really trying their best to up this, but it seems that they are really overwhelmed because, I mean, the latest figures, there's about a shortage of about 8,000 detectives alone in the police to investigate cases. And that makes it very difficult for law enforcement to really bring these levels down. Because at the end of the day, every case has to be investigated, a case has to be built, your docket has to be finalized, and then it has to go to the NPA and it has to be prosecuted. And in all those sectors, we have a severe manpower shortage.
And just a final one, and very quickly, I'm assuming that technology, and by that I mean probably social media, plays both a role in perpetuating and also preventing kidnappings in South Africa, potentially.
Of course, yeah, that is a new trend. And you know, the problem with the police is, you know, it seems that the criminals are always one step ahead. It is time for the police to invest in that, to train the people in that, to make sure that the resources are there for these officers in order to curb this, that they can be on the cutting edge when it comes to the latest technology in investigating and also preventing these cases.
I'm going to leave it there, Willem Els. Thank you very much indeed from the Institute for Security Studies.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A new row has erupted between Eskom and the Democratic Alliance. Writing in the Sunday Times, party leader John Steenhuisen claimed that the utility may be manipulating the power ecosystem to keep the lights on at all costs until the election on May the 29th. Joining us now is Mteto Nyati, who is the Eskom board chair. Mr. Nyati, welcome. And are you burning more diesel to keep the lights on because it's an election year?
Before I just answer that direct question, I just want to take a step back and look at what has happened really within Eskom. I think it was around March last year when the management of Eskom, supported by the new board, put together what is called a generation recovery plan. And that was approved by the board and also approved by the public enterprise. And management have been implementing that generation recovery plan, which is largely is really about doing maintenance for almost a year now. And where we are, Jeremy, right now is a reflection of the work that has been done by management over the last year. And the plan was a two-year plan, so we're just 1 year into that plan. We still have a long way to go, but we're already seeing some green shoots. So what we are seeing now and experiencing is a base that is more reliable, largely because of the maintenance. So we are certainly using what is called OCGTs, which is open cycle gas turbines. And we are using those open cycle gas turbines during peaking hours. And typically this happens in the mornings and also in the evenings. That's where you have peak demand. So instead of building new power stations for those peaks, you typically use the peaking plants, that is diesel. For the last financial year, we have used these OCGTs for more than peaking. And you'll find that we call it a load factor. We've used it at a load factor of about 18%. But this current financial year, this new financial year, our budget for these OCGTs is at 9%. So we have significant, in fact, we have halved the plan of using these things. So now we are almost a month into the new financial year. And our usage of these OCGTs is very much in line with the plan. We always use them during picking hours. So that is the situation, right, Jeremy.
So you would reject the assertion then that the utility is burning more diesel?
Yeah, I would reject this thing. I mean, we're using it the way these picking plants have always been used. It's designed to use them during picking hours, and we have always used them around that in this current financial year. And our performance is largely because we have much more stable stations right now at the back of maintenance. So that is the thing. There's an assumption that no, things have not improved in Eskom. At the core of where we are is because people have done the maintenance and we've improved. Mm. And it's coming through having what is called unplanned outages have come down significantly. Unplanned outages used to sit at about 19,000 megawatts. Right now, on average, our unplanned outages are about 13,000 megawatts. That is where the difference has happened.
But the problem going forward, though, is that you have to have a plan to reduce the dependency on these OCGTs. How much longer are you going to continue burning this diesel, which does come at a cost to the utility and the taxpayer?
This is why we're calling them, they were designed, OCGTs were always designed to be used, Jeremy, and they were designed to be used for peak hours. And that is what we're using them for. And we're not going to not use them. They were designed always to be there. But in the past, we were using them for much more than that. Hence, we ended up burning more diesel. But by design, this current financial year, we have halved our budget.
My question, though, was what are the long-term plans to reduce the dependency?
The long-term plan... You design them because you want to use them. They have got a use. You know, you need to use them for the purpose on which they were designed for. The purpose of OCGTs is to use them for peaking hours. And you use them there, and it's okay to use them during those hours. That's how, in the past, they were used for a wrong purpose. And right now, because things have improved significantly, we are using them largely for peaking hours.
All right, let me change direction of the conversation if I can. Do you believe then, given what you've told me, that you can confidently say that Eskom has now turned a corner?
No, I cannot say that. That would be a wrong thing to say. I told you that we've got a two-year plan. We are just a year into that two-year plan. What you are seeing now, we are seeing the benefits of the work that has been done over the last year. We still have another year to go of executing on this plan. That's when, if you were talking to me at this time next year, I would say so. But right now, I cannot say that.
We have a lot of political promises, and you would be aware of them, that say that load shedding is coming to an end.
So what is your point, Jeremy?
The point is load shedding coming to an end, is the question.
My point, I've told you, Jeremy, that we've got a two-year plan. We are a year into that two-year plan. We have another year to go. And at the end of that 2 years, I can confidently say to you that we are done with the work, and look, there won't be load shedding. Right now, where we're sitting, we still have a year to go on that plan.
Mteto Nyati, thank you very much for joining me.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
So, approaching a month then without load shedding, do we have more diesel to burn, to thank, or a little bit more sunshine? Energy commentator Nick Headley from the Progress Playbook is always a welcome guest and joins the conversation. And Nick, I've just spoken to the chairperson of Eskom, a lot more bullish, but not saying just yet that we've turned a corner. What's your view? What's your assessment?
He is correct to some extent. Eskom has put a lot of effort and kind of time and money into ramping up maintenance, which is fantastic because for many years Eskom was underinvesting in maintenance, partly just because it didn't actually have room to or budget to. So there has been an increased focus on maintenance, and particularly sort of in the height of the summer months in South Africa, we're kind of just reaching an end to, that's when we typically kind of ramp up maintenance as much as we can, because in the winter months is when we need a lot more electricity, when everyone starts switching on their heaters and things. So there was quite a bit of maintenance done over the summer months, and that is definitely kind of bearing fruit. On the other side, there is more supply as well from, obviously, households have installed a huge amount of rooftop solar, and that takes quite a bit of load off the grid, which gives Eskom even more room to kind of do maintenance. So South Africa's had a huge boom in rooftop solar, both by households and businesses, over the past kind of 2 years. And that's freeing up a lot of demand, which in turn kind of gives Eskom more room to do maintenance.
When I asked the chair whether we had turned a corner, essentially he said to me, talk to me again in a year. There is still a lot to do. So I'm sensing that there are lots of caveats and buts still within the process itself.
Absolutely. And actually, it's encouraging that he says that. I think in the past, heads of Eskom and the DMRE has sort of declared victory over load shedding, even though the system was still in a very precarious state. So it's encouraging that he's not sort of just declaring victory and giving us false hope, because the whole system is still in a very precarious state. So 7 of Eskom's 12 remaining coal plants are scheduled to reach their end of life by the end of this decade. That's a huge chunk of the old coal fleet that's nearing the end of its life and in kind of really bad shape, just because that's naturally what happens to very old technology with lots of moving parts. So the picture could change at any minute. You could see just unplanned breakdowns happening. So it's too early to declare full victory, but there is definitely some reason for optimism, which is obviously very encouraging.
Do you think there's still an over-reliance on open cycle gas turbines?
Absolutely. I think Eskom in this past financial year, I think the number is 36 billion rand that was spent on open cycle gas turbines. That's just absolutely burning cash away. There's no kind of long-term gain from that. It's a one-off burning 36 billion rand just to keep the lights on, with nothing to show for it after that. If you'd rather sort of put that 36 billion rand into extensive maintenance or investing in new grid capacity so that other new projects could come online, or just directly investing in new capacity, obviously that capacity sticks around for 20 years or whatever it might be, rather than just being sort of incinerated. So using diesel is absolutely not sustainable from an economic perspective. That said, now that we kind of have enough supply to meet demand, thankfully over the past couple of weeks, diesel use has declined, which is good for Eskom's budget, and hopefully that will last.
When you ferret about this issue, are you sensing a change of attitude or culture within Eskom?
It's a difficult one to answer, because there've always been really good people at Eskom who are kind of fighting the good fight, and there's really good people at the top now. As there has been for several years, but there are also really deeply corrupt sort of elements within Eskom and within the supply chain, including suppliers of goods. So it's a difficult one to... It does feel like the culture's kind of improving, but there's still those elements which are very difficult to kind of weed out. They're deeply entrenched in the system.
And extraordinary that it took us so long to get to this place.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a good kind of 25 years of policy failures and just putting ideology over practicality, basically. Unfortunately, that continues. So we desperately need, with 7 of our coal-fired power plants nearing the end of their life, we need huge amounts of new capacity. And unfortunately, the DMRE's new integrated resource plan sort of kicks the can down the road once again. And we've got almost a hiatus of new wind and solar projects specifically over the next few years, which is just bizarre, because the DMRE itself is forecasting that we'll have load shedding probably until 2028 at best. But despite that, is putting a sort of almost a full moratorium on wind and solar investments through the procurement process. So again, we're sort of maintaining this ideological stance over what's practical and what's actually really needed. So, but thankfully, for the first time now, the private sector is allowed to compete and invest in its own projects. So that's helping to solve things. So even though the government's failing to get the right sort of policies in place, at least it's not the only kind of player anymore, that's quite encouraging.
Nick Headley, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let me pivot now from power to politics, and a network of leaders from several Afrikaans organizations have released a statement outlining what they term is a way forward, considering what they term the serious crisis that the country is facing. Well, what's behind this? Werner Himan is the head of operations for the trade union movement Solidarity. He joins me now on MoneyWeb at Midday. And what has prompted this?
Firstly, I would say this is the acute crisis which our country faces. This is a country which we all love. This is a country where we all want to take part. And this has prompted various organizations, institutions, individuals to come together and say, what can we do as Afrikaners? What can we do as a cultural community in this country to lend a helping hand and to see how we can work together to solve the crises and be more part of this? We've drafted a statement with 12 points. And those 12 points we would like to have today. Actually, in a bit, we will be announcing this and giving more information with regards to that. But in essence, it's saying that we are staying here. And when we say we are staying here, it means much more than we are simply living here. To stay here means that you must make a difference. We all got that collective responsibility to do so. And this pledge is a confirmation of that intention of ours.
Werner, you talk about an acute crisis. What do you mean by that?
Well, firstly, what we mean is that our country is in crisis in the sense of the public infrastructure, in the sense of the load shedding crisis, service delivery. And throughout various civil organizations, we have institutions that focus on all of these aspects. And we think we can do even more. We think there's room to strengthen the horizontal level of where we are. That means where civil society is, where you live, where you can make a difference. But also to create on the vertical side a channel where we can... We can take these points further in discussions with provincial governments, with police stations, with provincial governments, with national government. So it's a multi-tiered process in order to achieve these ideals.
How long has the Afrikaans community been discussing this?
Well, we are a few organizations. We've started about, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, and just starting to say, what can we do to assist? And this culminated into this statement. It is impossible to get every single individual or every single institution involved from the start, but we are a meaningful a group that has met. If you look at our membership base, it's about 2 million people which we reach, which is a substantial one. We do not say that we speak on behalf of all South Africans or on behalf of all Afrikaners, but a sincere effort to say we've started something, we want to put it on the table, we want a discussion about it, and this is how it came about.
No coincidence that this announcement or this overture is made with less than 2 months to go before the election.
Yes, no, not at all. We think, and especially in the month of April, people are looking and contemplating the 30 years of democracy which we've had, but also looking forward. And that's the weight of this message, to say that we are looking forward. And another reason why it's important that we do it at this phase with less than a month or a month or so to go before the elections is to emphasize that it's important for all of us to take part in the democratic process, to vote, but also after elections, that we don't just sit back and say, now we wait for the next election. This is a call that between elections, it is opposite, it is suitable, it is appropriate to be more involved where you live and ask what you can do. And we hope that this statement would create an environment for people to put in and assist with all of this.
It could be seen as the Afrikaans community retreating into a longer.
That is so. That is a perception that exists. We think actually that it's better to issue the statement to make our intentions clear, to answer all questions, especially to answer that and address those perceptions that exist. This is a process of inclusion, not exclusion. Without this statement, we are less organized, we are less involved, and we believe that this statement will ultimately reach more and more people. I think the 12 statements that we've made, or the 12 points that we've made, is something which most people would find accord with. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to agree with every sentence or every word. It's hard enough to draft a document. But we believe and we find that most people can read it and say they can live with this. They can understand where we're coming from. And this is where we say that how you can advance unity and diversity. This is a diversity side in action, bringing people on ground level more together to effect change where they live and what they do.
Is this not just a proxy push for a party like the Freedom Front Plus, for instance?
Well, I think the first thing to note is we have been very clear on this, that there's no political affiliation with regards to this. All of the institutions involved are civil institutions. No political party has been involved in this process. And so we have no line or any form of support that we give to any political party. If there's a political party that says they can abide by this, and this includes the DA, this includes the IFP, they include other parties as well, they can say that this splits according to how they view things, but not at all. Our emphasis is not on the party political side, but more on the broad political side. And what I mean by that is that the broad political side means you participate, you act, you are part of the democratic process, which is not only inclusive of elections.
Just a final one. Given the diversity within the Afrikaans community, it's going to be difficult for the signatories of this pledge or declaration to address varying opinions and perspectives. You're going to end up arguing with each other a lot, aren't you?
Well, a lot of the process up to now has been debate and discussions between us. And there's no doubt that there will be some debate and argue about this. But we've been at pains to after this statement and after the media statement, we have reached out to several organizations within our broader language community and other civil organizations to convey this is the intention of these statements, and it's been received well. There has been certain people who say that they cannot accord themselves, and they've also written it in the media today completely with the statement, but overall we find that most people say this is a positive development. It's us reaching out a hand, trying to take it together with another one, but we are ready for the debate and the discussions. We think that is a positive thing, Jeremy. We welcome that, and we think this is an opportunity to clear any misperceptions that we are. And we're also saying, if I might just add, that we don't try and achieve a point where we are all in 100% agreement, but we think it is achievable to say the broad aims of what we achieve, we think we would get most people on board with regards to that.
I am going to leave it there, Werner Human. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally, my next guest says consumers may have stepped into 2024 hopeful for a financial reprieve as food inflation eased towards the end of last year. But there have been a number of other knocks, and this is having an impact on the housing market, and specifically why so many homes are now out of reach for people who want to buy them. Zandile Mahobe is with us now, an economist and the lead specialist of research and analytics at Liberty. Thank you for joining us today. The premise of your argument is it's becoming a lot tougher to buy and own a home. Give me the correlation between interest rates and housing costs right now and how much tougher it's getting.
So, Jeremy, if you just think about owning a property, and I think we've seen this quite a lot in the news and in the newspapers lately, where the impact of the interest rate really changes how much one is paying towards their mortgage. A home of 1 million today, the interest with the interest changes has increased so much that people are now committing, say, 4,000 extra towards that mortgage repayment. And for many households, these changes have become unbearable, and they are then forced to look at an alternative in terms of how they put a roof over their heads.
And that alternative for people, and particularly younger people, is now becoming rental. And often rental is also out of the pocket range of many people.
100%. So as we see more people gravitating towards the rental market, hoping that it will be cheaper, what you're actually starting to see is this uptick in demand on the rental side, which then drives up rental rates. I think because we are in a bit more of a tough economic environment, there is argument at least for lower increases on that rent, but the role of demand will see rates increase for renters.
And Zandile, none of this is helped by administered prices either, are they?
Not at all. So if you just look at the housing segment in the CPI, it's inclusive of the rental component, but also things like putting your lights on. So electricity and water are key to the measure there. And we know that, you know, in April, we see the tariff increase on electricity. So our electricity costs are going up by double digit numbers at 12.7%. We are also seeing rises in water supply. So around 8% increase there on the housing component. So while we are seeing a lot of pressure on other factors such as food, fuel, and so on, the home element has one that hasn't really been on the radar for many, given that we've got more immediate things at hand. But it's not one that can be ignored, especially given that it does take up a significant proportion of people's household balance sheets.
So if there is a decline in credit granted for mortgages, how are financial institutions being forced to adjust their lending practices?
So here, Jeremy, I think it is an opportunity for us to become a little bit more creative. And the thing that really joins us together in terms of looking at this is what we now start to see in terms of the property market itself. So if you look at the Lightstone property inflation, which is probably the only inflation we want to see as consumers, it's been really, really low. It's, I think the last report was around 2.6% year-on-year growth in house prices. So we're seeing a loss of value because there is weak demand in the property market. So there's an incentive for us to see the house market grow and become stable. And I think the role that financiers can do is start to rethink how we look at pricing those interest rates. So yes, the repo rate plays a significant role, but are we looking broader in terms of how we price risk to be able to help communities to afford homes? Because we do see that in South Africa, that is the desire. A lot of families seek to own their home as an asset and as something that they can pass on to the next generation. And I think that the financial sector has a role to play there, because we play a big part in terms of making that dream come true.
So very quickly then, how do you price risk more creatively?
What we've seen just in terms of global research is looking at other ways to balance the scale. So we talk a lot about ESG, and in ESG, the S stands for the social element. So there's a big social element in terms of providing housing and creating stability in communities in terms of the shelter component. So how we look at this is to provide more value around that S element. So instead of purely looking at a profit outcome, how can we look at a social outcome, a property market stability outcome? And that might make us look at risk a little bit differently. It might see us, you know, adjusting rates a little bit lower for certain circumstances so that people can be able to afford those homes.
Thank you very much indeed, Zandile Makoba from Liberty. On our online poll Friday, and this is just before I say goodbye, we spoke about South Africa's entrepreneurial potential. I asked if it was getting better, if we have a poor environment, or if you've tried and failed. And most of our respondents, in fact, around two-thirds, saying that the environment at the moment is poor. Today, and it relates to two of the interviews that I did, we've had almost a month without load shedding. Are you seeing a real recovery? Do you believe what the DA is saying, that there is some system manipulation, or is it simply a case of more sunshine? If you have a view on that, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We're live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.